Welcome to the Composer Studio Podcast.
I'm Anna Linville.
And I'm Tara Ghirardella. And today our guest composer is Douglas Boyce. Boyce writes chamber music that draws on medieval and Renaissance traditions and modernist aesthetics, building rich rhythmic structures that shift between order, fragmentation, elegance, and ferocity. Many of his works have a direct historical touchstone. Other works draw on sources from antiquity, literature, and philosophy. Boyce has been awarded the League of Composers ISCM Composers Award, the Salvatore Maturano Prize, the Robert Avalon Prize, and a Fromm Commission, just to name a few. Douglas, it's such a pleasure to have you on the show today.
It's lovely to be here. I felt appropriate to get some fresh caffeine. And of course, I'm at my office and the line at the local Pete's is full of students furiously trying to finish their term papers before Thanksgiving break. So it took a little longer than anticipated.
It's perfectly fine. Well, cheers. And
cheers.
Welcome to the show.
Slanja. Slanja.
All right. Well, we are back at it again. And, you know, Douglas, I was getting to know your music before we started recording the show and spending the week learning about you and everything that is a part of you and what makes you who you are and what makes you the composer that you are. And I know you've answered this question a gazillion times, but our listeners are definitely going to want to know. You're a guitarist. Punk music was your first introduction into music. And, you know, where did that transition happen for you from punk to classical or anything in between?
Well, I'd probably say it sort of happened all at once. It's not so much me. First of all, thank you for suggesting that I'm a guitarist. I think that's giving me a certain degree of credit that is probably not due. If I did some, you know, personal archaeology, I could probably come up with a date. But I know very precisely when I became interested in music, and I had not been interested in music previously. And it's for a variety of just happenstance and family things. I had an advanced videotape release, so ahead of the release of the Talking Heads Stop Making Sense film. And before that, I had some. I had done some music. My mother was a singer. It was present. It was in the house, right? But it was nothing I was particularly good at, nothing I was particularly interested in. I'd taken, you know, a month and a half of piano lessons. And I had started to play trombone in the marching band because my brother played trombone. My mother bought a trombone, and then he went to college and didn't take the trombone with him. And she said, "God damn it, someone is going to play this trombone." So it was that sort of relationship to music. It was not really any particular affection. And I saw that film and listened to it and was astounded by a couple of things. One was the fact that while there's some great players on that record, it's not like they're fabulous players. It's as a rule, as you get to know Talking Heads music, you know, they kind of could get around but that's not what it was. There was a certain sense, well, anybody could do this, which really for me was the reason punk was the entry point, that you could almost immediately out of the gate do stuff and do strange stuff and do different stuff and do novel stuff. But also for me, Stop Making Sense is formally fascinating. And I haven't watched it in a few years, but every once in a while I go back And it holds, and it holds up quite wonderfully. It's a very simple rhetoric of there's a solo performer on a bare stage, then it's a duo, then it's a trio, then it's a quartet. And the stage itself then is filled in and there's visual projections behind it. And I remember being very struck by the way that those 70 minutes, 80 minutes, a fairly short film. It has a beautiful architecture to the time. And so in some ways, more than becoming a strong player or you know, developing certain kinds of skills, I was interested in those, but I was really interested in time. I was really interested in how to organize spans of time. And a particular spans of time, longer spans of time, while starting off in punk rock, it was when we had a song that was 45 seconds long, we felt like that was a pretty long number, you know, and there's a wonderful tradition of the miniature and the fragment in the punk tradition. And so that's absolutely where I started. But I was always interested in the question of how do you organize larger spans of time? At that moment that I became interested, I then started studying classical piano and got sort of went in, bought the worst, cheapest guitar I could find and tried to. So I was like teaching myself guitar on my own, but doing a very traditional path into classical music, because in very different ways, they were interested in the same thing. They were interested in how to organize time. In so much punk music, extremely fast, extremely brief periods of time. And so it's how do you have 30 seconds that have enough happening in them that it's worthy of being called a song? And as I became interested in classical music and chamber music in particular, in some ways it's the same question. It's how do you have enough? How do you have the right events in the right order to fill half an hour to justify suggesting that people sit and listen to something for 40 minutes, right? It's very different parameters, but it's the same question. And so it's not for me. Now, there was absolutely a moment where I would, a couple of times, my focus really shifted when I was an undergraduate. By my junior year, I was very interested in jazz and playing a lot of jazz, playing a lot of very long improvised music, freer and freer, less and less in the harmonic control. But I was also very interested in chamber music and writing a little bit of orchestral music and art songs and things like that. There were practical choices. There were a series of practical and aesthetic choices that led me to doing the kind of music that would put me into a grad program. And so yes, those are significant, but compared to the leap into music in general, they're actually pretty minor. It's that first leap that was the salto mortale, right? If we were talking to a dancer, they would talk about. So maybe that answers your question. Is that?
It does. it's very fascinating. The whole discussion about time in music and the manipulation of time in music. And I find it really fascinating. You're only the second person I've ever heard talk about it this way. The first was John Cage.
Whoa. Okay. I'll take that for a dollar.
Well, let's go ahead and take a listen to your piano quartet number 2 from 3 pieces. This was commissioned by the Music Teachers National Association and the Maryland Music Teachers Association, premiered by and dedicated to the Kenyon Quartet. You want to tell us a little bit about the Kenyon Quartet?
Well, it is what it said. It's an amateur group. They're not really playing together anymore. But a student of mine, Chase Maggiano, who's now gone on to do all sorts of interesting work in music administration, and he ran Gay Men's Chorus in D.C. and he's a violinist, and there's a whole story about Chase, and I knew him before he came to GW. And I don't think he'll mind if I share this. And I kind of, he had left school somewhere else. He was thinking about coming back and finishing a degree. And I sort of helped say, well, what would it mean if he came to GW? He ended up coming to GW and being in the department with us. Great guy. Fine. Really fine violinist. And he, you know, had this group and the teachers organization was interested in something. And I want to thank them all because I sort of tried to write a piece of maybe a bit less than my standard level of technical demands on the performers, but it's still a pretty fierce, pretty complicated piece. They did a wonderful job on the first couple of performances. But at the same time, I think it's an interesting piece in the catalog because while it is sort of less virtuoso than some of the other music that's involved, it's one of the more overt manifestations of a sort of designed aleatory in my music, which again I think ties back to some of these early experiences I had in jazz and in more free, more open improvisations. And so you hear in it a sort of moving back and forth between these very open textures, very much in the Ludovskian tradition, to these very ordered, very managed passages that are much more in the sort of Bartok, Stravinsky tradition of this rhythmic complexity, which leads to a very sort of complicated dance feel, maybe. And so I think that would be something as we listen to it to think about those transitions from the openness of the aleatory into the more ordered and from an open pulse to a shared pulse. And that itself having rhetorical and structural meaning.
Well, let's go ahead and listen. This is Piano Quartet Number 2 by Douglas Boyce. Thank you.
I said, damn, that is an awesome piece. I was following along with the score that you sent. It's a hard score to follow.
it keeps you on your feet.
Oh, man, I'm sorry. I totally derailed us from the momentum of the show, but I just got to tell you, that is a fantastic piece of music.
I would hope that's part of the momentum of the show. no, but thank you. It's I sometimes write very ferociously difficult pieces, and they're kind of showcases. I have some wonderful friends and people that I love collaborating with, and it's a bit of sort of saying, "Yeah, sure, Dan can do anything," and sort of get Dan to do something. This is one that, in some ways, I think more than the other two pieces that we're going to look at tonight, it's very much in the chamber music tradition. It is very much in how does this group of four people, of four players, when do they pair, and it's two pairs against one another, and when is it three with one as a solo, and when is the piano absent and it's just these strings, when is the piano solo. I think in some ways for me it was a bit of a study in that question. It precedes some later pieces that engage with that, maybe just as overtly, but very elaborately, larger forces, longer periods of time, and this enormous piano trio. It's like 40 minutes long, something like that. And even more systematically, even though it's a smaller ensemble, it's longer, and it really systematically says, what is a movement where the strings are paired? And it's almost as if there are two voices in these. And then another movement is much more about being a quartet, and the other is a collection of soloists moving over. For me, from the period when this came from, this is probably the chamber piece from that moment that I think captures the most of what I do. It has this rhythmic energy and this metrical temporal play. It has this sort of I like music with corners. I like music where turns happen and changes happen. But at the same time, I think it's integrated. So it's not just oppositions of contrast. It's you go someplace and it's different in many ways, but it then carries some things forward from the previous one.
We should mention that the piece we just heard, Piano Quartet Number 2, is part of a set of three. And it's from your album, Hunt by Night, by Trio Cavatina, Hunt by Night.
Right. So it was recorded by Trio Cavatina, which is Harumi Rhodes, violin, Priscilla Lee, cello, Yeva Yokobovichute, who I work with a lot and is really a dear friend, and Beth Goodrin Chu on viola, to sort of expand them to the quartet. One wonderful recording and a recording made at Octavin Audio in New York, which is pretty much my favorite place on the planet to be. Whenever I get to do something up there, it's just delightful.
Now, you talked before we listened to the piece about aleatory, and I don't know if everyone who's listening to the show knows what that is, so maybe you could just give us a little quick.
Sure.
Definition of what you see as aleatory, because you also write about, you know, sort of controlling it or having some kind of structure to your aleatory. So I don't know if anybody knows about aleatory music. It's hard to imagine that being structurable in any way.
Right, right. Well, it's interesting. So, alea comes from the Latin and it comes from dice, throwing dice, though it actually means knuckles. Because you take like the knuckle bones from something, and those would be the dice that you tossed. And so aleatory, I think it's an interesting reference because it speaks, it has a mathematical component to it where you set certain parameters and you know, because you're throwing two six-sided dice, there are only so many numbers that could possibly come up, right? You sort of limit the field of possibilities. But at the same time, you can't really determine them entirely. But I also love that the sort of capture of the phrase in musical circles that if you think about the root of that word, of the Latin root of that word, it's a game, right? It's not just about managing the odds. It's about playing and openness and playfulness. And so one thing that I love about aleatoric devices and improvisation is that playfulness, that necessary playfulness, where people sort of on the fly need to say, oh, we're at this point, we're at this part of the piece. At the same time, I think you're exactly right that I'm interested, I refer to it a couple different ways, but I think mostly, and maybe this is what made your ears prick up, it is a designed aleatory. Right? It's not actually open. It is somewhat open. Right? So it's an interesting question as to how to notate things, and we were talking a little bit about what the score. looks like. What I came to realize for early on when I began to be interested in this, there's such a tendency for the energy to evacuate the room. Everybody's waiting for something. And so most of the time in music, there's some clear prompt, there's some clear trigger. And in the parts, you know, might not be in the score, but in the parts, everything's wait until the violin does such and such, right? And I've got little cues in it. But then the violin is free to make that choice. But then the violist is waiting for the cellist to do whatever. Right? And I'm interested in that for a couple of reasons. One is that I was writing music with really complicated rhythmic notation to try to get these very sort of complex textures to happen. And a couple of just in accident in rehearsal on a couple of pieces when I was a student, like things went badly, but it was exactly what I wanted, right? It was within there. And I said, wait a minute, maybe there's a way to be more efficient about this. So some of the what sounds like very complex textures opening in the beginning, they're not difficult to play. Now, I think you're right that they're difficult to negotiate. They're difficult. It presents particular challenges because we can't. And I enter at bar 57. Well, no, I enter at some point when a certain prescribed event happens. I love that because it is you can't fake your way through it. You have to be attentive. You have to be attentive to your fellow players. And for me, that's the beautiful, wonderful, exquisite, unsurpassed thing in chamber music.
That's a bit like jazz too. I mean,
absolutely.
You know, the negotiation between the different players and the
absolutely.
There's a lot of aleatoric possibility in jazz.
And yet,
but within a structure.
And yet somehow there needs to be a very rapid articulation of when we're going to do this number.
Mm-hmm.
The other thing that so in a lot of ways, my scores, they look a lot of those scores that have a lot of aleatory look a lot like Ludoslavsky. And what I came to realize as I used it more and more, I'd done a lot of improvisation during my master's degree in Oregon. I play a lot of Cobra, John Zorn's game, his improvisation system. And the thing that I loved about it was how it could turn on a dime. It was open, it was very, very open, but you had events. And it's, I don't know if anyone has.
Is it a video game? What is it? Exactly?
It's a series of, I still have my cards up there. It's a series of cards with letters on them that in real time, players call for something. Mouth two, I put my finger on my mouth two. And they call the conductor and make a call. And that means runner. And runner means that caller gets to define who's playing next. And then the conductor makes everybody knows that that's happening, and boom, and he calls the beat. And there's a big set of options and ways. And then there are ways that the system undermines itself. And if you put a hat on, you're a gorilla, and you get to do whatever you want. And it's just very, very silly, really fun to play. Great teaching tool.
Cobra. Okay.
And it's I loved it because it could turn on a dime. And I became very interested in, and it speaks exactly to what I was talking about before in pieces about how things shift, how over time A is different than B. But there's this interesting transition between A and B, which is maybe just as interesting as A and B, right? Those sorts of things. And so as I began to incorporate improvisation with different degrees of notation. Some of my pieces are really very open. More and more, they're not as open. I think it shows up, but it's not as central. What I realized that what I really love about it is the transition from openness, from open time to metered time, from aeon to chronos, right? From the flux to the clock. Because I like Flux and I like clocks, but I really like coming the transitions in and out of them. And because you can get pretty rich textures fairly easily out of aleatoric devices, if you're careful about how you do the prompts and think about it, you can, in some ways, you can spend some of your composer points in other parts of the piece writing more complex music, so long as you have people that are on board for this very active engagement with it. So I think aleatory is a good word because it's not improvisation. Some of my pieces do have plenty of improvisation. The first piano quartet actually has this. The whole thing is sort of an enormous viola sonata, the viola solo, which they have prompts, they have some things they can do, but they pretty much do what they want to do. So I am interested in that. But aleatory, it hits a different spot for me because you see the negotiations. And I can... this sounds a little controlling maybe, but not so much that I can manipulate the choices, but I know where some of those choices are going to happen. I know where some of those conversations are going to happen. And I think, again, very much in the Stravinskyan tradition, I think that's kind of what composers do. Color and notes and harmony and rhythm and all that stuff is just a way of setting up moments of transition between different temporal structures and patterns. But it's not so much that it happens quickly, but it's that the distance that you've transitioned from these very open spaces to these very metered spaces, for me, is very dramatic or very rhetorically interesting, very suggestive.
Well, let's go ahead and move on to the next piece. This next piece of yours that we're going to listen to is called Pygmalion, and this is where you really dive into some of the mythology that you were talking about that you're so interested in and that you like to use as an element of your music. Can you tell us a little bit about the piece before we listen to it?
In some ways, it's indirectly interested in mythology. In some ways, it's more interested in history. It came about as a part of a show that my ensemble, Counterduct Show up in New York, was doing, good Lord, in 2007 or 2008, something like that. And Ryan Strieber, this is great. I'm pitching Ryan a bunch because Ryan runs Octavin. Ryan is Octavin Audio. Incredible engineer, wonderful person, incredible musician, fabulous composer. And we were working with Ryan on something, and he very much wanted to do a set of pieces sort of derived from the Torino Codex, which is it's an interesting case of sort of late Ars Nova, Ars Subtiliorum music, but it's from Cyprus, even though they found the manuscript in Turin, which is why it's the Turin Codex. It's from Cyprus, where those Ars Subtilior devices of sort of late medieval music persisted after they'd sort of fallen out of favor. And so it's historically really interesting. There's some really exquisite music. And Ryan got a bunch of us to compose pieces that in some ways started in some sort of commentary with those sources. So there's a motet in the collection that has a text and engages with the Pygmalion mythology, though it's also interesting in that there are readings of the text from that collection that actually situate them politically in the funny position that Cyprus had as, you know, a European, essentially sort of a French vassal state, but so close to the Levant, and so right in this moment of these great tensions after some of the Crusades, so
which still persists to this day. Actually, Cyprus is still a divided place.
Oh yeah, so absolutely, exactly. So yeah. It's sort of like it's right there, and. this is one of the first times I met Ryan, and I immediately was like, we are friends forever after this. Because I had been developing for a long time these interests in earlier music, not necessarily the Torino Codex. My dissertation work was on the Montpellier Codex, so a bit earlier than this. And for me, though, this piece is, while it has both an interesting mythic connection and a very interesting historical connection, it was also for me, a very technical piece. It was a piece about looking at this particular variety of ars subtilior music and thinking about, in some ways, asking myself the question, is this already reflected in my music? How close am I to it? So this is far from my first interaction with this music, but it was one where I really sort of said, okay, let's just name it. Let's just say that it's from, and I could maybe I should have brought it along. There are many excellent recordings of this particular piece, and it's a wonderful piece. And rather than sort of writing something in style, in the period style, I think about something of writing about something that, might bridge them. And in doing so, I think made me realize how much of that music is in every music that every bit of music that I write. The way I think about counterpoint is in some ways obviously very much in the Baroque tradition and in the Renaissance tradition that we all sort of study, but that 15th, 14th century stuff, it's incredible. And again, I think you can make an interesting case that one of the reasons it's still so striking is that the temporal, rhythmic, and metrical organization is so rich and so intricate. And I had developed this interest in engaging with contemporary music. And then, as I was saying before, when Jenny Bloxham sort of won the day and sort of defeated me, this was the stuff that fascinated me. Maybe that relates to the question you were asked or not. But that's how I think about it. Actually, a very technical piece.
So we're going to go ahead and listen to this now. This is a piece called Pygmalion, performed by Counterinduction. The performers are Sumire Kudo on cello and Ben Fingland on clarinet. Thank you. That was Pygmalion, composed by Douglas Boyce, our guest today, and it was performed by Counterinduction. The performers were Sumita Kudo on cello and Ben Fingland on clarinet. What a wonderful piece, Douglas. You know, such great moments that ending is so beautiful. And I love how the instruments are sharing the trills going back and forth and the interplay between them. And I also have to say that during the course of the piece, there were times when I was just caught up in listening to it that I forgot that it was just a cello and a clarinet. It felt so much bigger.
Well, thank you very much for that. I mean, I don't know if we'll slide my swearing from our last conversation into this one, but I have a tremendous, really profound love of chamber music, of the event of going into a relatively small space with a relatively small audience interacting with a relatively small collection of musicians. There's something wonderfully intimate about it, but something that the modern condition and some, and I also sometimes talk about this, but as a composer, sort of living in a post-virtuosic moment, you know, players can do so much now. I mean, just the things that were unthinkable 20 years ago, 30 years ago are pretty standard now. And in some ways, we've been given a license, if we're careful in how we use it, to just find wonderful colors and textures I think some people talk about it as like reduced forces. Like that's the way orchestra people always say about reduced forces. Oh no, it's reduced forces. When for me, what I love about reduced forces is that it makes, for me as a practitioner, it makes me say, I need color here. I need a different color. What are all of the ways that I know to make color from this? How the sort of warp and weft of music, of the way they talk about texture as right. The fabric is sort of two different threadings. One is the warp, one is the weft. What is at my disposal? And the beauty of working in chamber music is that it makes you very, you get very good. And it's very joyful. There's this wonderful joy of saying, oh my goodness, if I am able to do this and do this, I can make this happen with two people on stage, with three people on stage. And I mentioned this in some of our comments. For me, that's from, I studied as one of the last students to get to study with George Crumb before he retired from UPenn. And many, many things about George's music that is astounding, which is sort of beyond. But the way he thinks about color and texture is formally significant as something that profoundly impacts the way a piece unfolds. Sometimes my music actually does sound a bit like George. I think it's always risky to try to sound like George because nobody else can really pull it off. But you certainly find traces. But even when I'm not sort of in his exquisitely cosmic domain, they were always sort of wonderfully practical, just sort of like, well, you know, what is that bow doing? What is that? Where is that? Where? Just these very little things, but the care given to those little things, and I am not suggesting that my music pulls off what George does. But in George's, it's often these tiny little things that produce these incredible effects. And that was really sort of my great takeaway, that carefulness makes that intimacy open up into something even wider and bigger. And so you get this transition from this tiny space to this enormous sound world. And I think sorry, go ahead.
Oh, I was going to say, you were talking earlier a little bit about drawing on other traditions, historic traditions, but also being in the present and how history informs the present.
I wouldn't even say informs. I would say constitutes. I think the present is just our experience of the past. It's everything. We hide it. We think it's other things, but the now is constituted from, much philosophers like Stiegler would talk about, the historicity, the traces of the things that are around us. That's what we call the present. It's little bits of the past that are now hanging out with us.
You know, we've talked a lot about kind of high philosophical ideas and complicated, our place in space time. I'd like to kind of pull back a little bit and get more personal with the next piece, Sails Knife Bright in a Seasonal Wind. It's also on the album Counter Induction. This piece is personal for you. It has something, it's been dedicated to your son, Tiernan.
Well, I don't want to sort of hedge my bets, but I do think that at a certain point, all the pieces become personal. You know, especially for, again, this is one of the things I love about chamber music. It's I'm writing this for this friend. I'm writing this for this thing, and you sort of, and it grows on you.
But this seems to have a different.
Absolutely. And so this is one where, although I will admit, I should clarify, the name. The poem that it's referencing, the connection to him, doesn't precede the me working on the piece, right? Mm-hmm. For me, lots of times the Pygmalion is a not great example, because it was Ryan had an idea for a concert and I wrote a piece for it. But much of the times I sort of find connections, I find the association. I'm working on something, again, at a very technical level. Hey, this is a nice collection of pictures. This is an interesting rhythm. And then as I sort of live with it for a couple of months, I come to some conclusion about what it might connect to.
But the title comes from Eric Mahon's Achille.
Well, you know? So I've loved Mahon's poetry have for a long time. Read a bunch of it. It's sort of always floating around. And so I was, thinking about a piece for some version of this mixture. It's a percussion guitar violin piece. So very intimate. It's one of the few pieces you'll hear with sort of a castanet cadenza, right? It is very reduced little setup. And so I'm thinking about it. I had been quite ill. I was coming out of being ill. My little guy, my son, Tiernan, was really kind of starting to grow up, to be sort of active. To be, to be a real entity. I say this lovingly, but babies are loud lumps when they show up, right? And he was beginning to. The play was really wonderful, but at the same time, that does make you think about finitude and thinking about how do you connect with people and people passing, the generations, taking care of the generations. And mm-hmm. throw a little Stiegler quote in. I think it was by chance. Maybe I just remembered it, but I was looking through some Mahon, and I came upon this particular poem. Actually, why don't I can't really print the whole poem. You're right.
Copyright.
Yeah, but I'll read it, and we'll see if you get in trouble. again, I can't remember if I remembered it or if I just stumbled through it. But I was thinking about my boy and being apart from my boy and being how connections come and pass and shift. And so I came upon this poem by the Irish poet, Derek Mahon, Achille. He just passed recently in 2020, which is a shame. So here's the poem. I'll try to do it justice. I lie and imagine a first light gleam in the bay after one more night of erosion and nearer the grave. Then stand and gaze from the window at break of day, as a shearwater skims the ridge of an incoming wave. And I think of my son, a dolphin in the Aegean, a sprite among the sails, knife bright in a seasonal wind, and wish he were here where Karaks walk on the ocean, to ease with his talk the solitude locked in my mind. I sit on a stone after lunch and consider the glow of the sun through the mist, a pearl bulb contained fierce. A rain shower darkens the schist for a moment or so, and then drifts away, and the slow black patches disperse. Krogpatrick towers like Naxos over the water, and I think of my daughter at work on her difficult art, and wish she were with me now between thrush and plover, wild thyme and sea thrift, to lift the weight from my heart. The young sit smoking and laughing on the bridge at evening, like birds on a telegraph pole or notes on a score. A tin whistle squeals in the parlor. Once more it is raining. Turf smoke inclines, and a wind whines under the door. And I lie and imagine the lights going on in the harbor of White House Nausa, your clear definition at night, and wish you were here to upstage my disconsolate labor. As I glance through a few thin pages and switch off the light.
Pretty.
And
very pretty.
Yeah, he's pretty amazing. Yeah. And you know, while it is about, it's about children, it's about connections, family, it is also, I think about the, maybe the necessary retreat of the artist, that there is this stepping back, right? There's this machinery running in your head in a way that you connect and disconnect and reconnect and disconnect with people and the things that you love and the people that you love. It's one of the things where I find it a very sad poem, but a very beautiful poem. And that's very interesting that we can make, that humans figured out how to make a very beautiful, very sad poem. Hmm. And so for me, the reference of Mahone's reference to children and it's still hopeful, I think, as a poem. There's still this idea it's as if the detachment is temporary. Mm-hmm. I'm coming out of some sickness and not in the best of spirits. And thinking about writing a kind of intimate piece for a peculiar little ensemble, come upon this poem. And while I'm doing this, I'm watching my boy dance and play and begin to really engage with music. We wake up every morning with a couple of Bach cantatas. When he was young, I had him on a very strict diet. There were really only two things on his playlist. There was a bunch of Obrecht, and there was a bunch of Marvin Gaye. That was, I figured that would sort of like set the right balance. And he also went through his subtilior period for his, he held on to his third nap, his afternoon nap for a very long time. And he wanted like serious Montpellier Ars Subtiliores stuff. But it was hilarious because he wanted to be bundled up and put down, and he would only sleep for like 5 minutes, but he like wanted that music on and he wanted that moment. But by this point, when I'm writing this, it's about activity and in particular about that energy right before sleep, right before bedtime, where again, I don't know if you do have kids, but there is this burst of energy that they will not deny before the collapse. And so it's a piece that has this sort of, I think, hopefully, has this sort of this smallness, this delicacy, and these little moments where sort of playful things happen, and it sort of then dissolves out into sleep. And as parents, you know that delight when parents look at one another and say, "Is he down? Is he really down?" And that, and so it's definitely about that moment in between, where sort of down. And so the Mahone, and that passage of the Mahone, the way you watch your child imagining things, and you watch your child dream, and you try to figure out what those dreams are, and you're kind of close and you get something about it, but there's also this distance because you don't actually get that sense of it. Mm-hmm. And so hopefully this is one of my more sort of coloristic, sort of meditative, impressionistic kind of pieces.
Well, let's go ahead and listen to it now. This is Sales Knife Bright in a Seasonal Wind, performed by Counterinduction, Miranda Cuxon violin, Dan LaPelle guitar, and Jeffrey Irving percussion. Thank you. That was Sales Knife Bright in a Seasonal Wind by our guest today, composer Douglas Boyce. Douglas, it's a fascinating piece, and I loved following along, watching what all the different instrumentalists were doing and the work that the percussionists had to do that whole time, switching back and forth and the meter changes and the instrument changes. It was just really incredible and fascinating piece of music. I'm very intrigued by how words and music connect, and knowing that this piece had a lot of personal connections for you, but also connected to a poem. I was wondering how you came up with this content based on the words that you pulled it from.
Well, as I was saying before, I was working on a piece for them before I had the poem. It's not like a setting. But I think that says it, that itself says something about how I work when I, and in some ways you could argue that the aleatory, even when it's not in the piece, has entwined itself in my process. You know, I start off with certain factors, certain features that I'm interested in. Often it's instrumentation. I'm writing something for particular people because there's a particular show and, you know, planning things out in the future. Sometimes I do things like Georges Perec and the Oulipo authors would do and give myself a constraint. I do, with some frequency, I do soggetto cavato, like the Renaissance tradition of, you know, you're putting the letters of someone's name in the piece, which is a lovely thought, but then you sometimes end up with like just a really terrible collection of pitches that you don't know how to write a piece for. Let's just say I've started more of those than I've written them. Because sometimes it's like, no. But you don't want to tell someone, I was going to do this for you, but your name really stinks.
Yeah, Shostakovich got lucky.
Yeah, he got lucky, exactly. And that's an interesting case because it's in some ways it starts off with a framework, but also in some ways that framework is arbitrary. And you have this puzzle of like, I don't know what this is. But the connection to the person you're thinking of sometimes, and like I said, sometimes it doesn't go this way and I stop trying to write the piece. But sometimes, I think probably most of the time, it's a lovely way to give yourself some sort of thing to wrestle with. You also have the touchstone, the Wegmarken of the person. She's always the person I'm writing it for. I don't write them to dedicate it for other people to play. Sometimes there's more than one person involved, but that the person I'm writing for is going to be playing it. And in some ways, I think my relationship to text, unless I'm setting a text, is kind of like that. I have things in my mind. Sometimes it precedes the piece, but often it's like I'm thinking about a piece. I'm thinking about a color. I've always got poetry or philosophy by the bed, and I'm always reading things, or I remember something, and that makes me think about such and such. And then I go back and I reread a book, and I reread some Henry James, or I reread some Wallace Stevens, and I find a connection to it. And for me, the connection, I'm just old enough now to trust that it'll mean something, but I don't. The way I engage with it in the process is not to represent the text, right? It's that there's something that I'm reading and there's something that I'm working on. And as I'm developing my thoughts and my understanding about what the piece is, probably my understanding and my thinking about the text or the poem is also evolving and changing and shifting. So in some ways for me, the titles, and I have a bit of a tendency to have sort of ridiculous titles for pieces. That's in some ways for me, that's more of often it's just sort of a trace of the process. In some ways it's like, this is what I was reading when I was working on this piece. Which is not to belittle it, because it's not just the thing I was reading, but the thing that I was engaging with or thinking about, and the thing that kept coming back to me as I was working.
It was
on
generative in some way.
Exactly. It's right? Exactly the right word. The engagement with it led to something. Meaning something that comes later, right? That comes after somebody listens to it. That comes after something gets settled in. But if it's generative, if it's resonating for me, mm-hmm. then I have kind of come to the conclusion, like, it's a good bet that it'll lead me in a direction that's meaningful for other people, that has the potential for meaningfulness for other people. And it's, and it, you know, right now, actually, I'm doing a bunch of, I had written a lot of vocal music when I was young. I'd said a lot of text when I was a student, and I kind of stepped away from it for a long time. But while still also writing these texts, like my piano trio has like all of these quotations from Aristotle and C.S. Pearson and William James as all of the character markings throughout. So clearly, like, I'm interested in text, but I wasn't setting them. And 5-6 years ago, I finished recording. I finished writing, and we did a recording of a set of songs for a dear friend. Down here in DC, and in some, it took a while to sit, but the songs were sort of percolating in my head. What is it to set text? And are there more immediately connective ways of connecting text with music than what I have been doing? Which is not that I don't want to give this feeling that I'm sort of moving on, or I'd sort of disagree with that gesture. I think they're related ways of engaging with text. And so in the middle of, in the pandemic, there's a group of two young singers out in the Midwest heard some of my stuff and contacted me. And so I'm writing a bunch of things for them. I've got a couple other sort of art song projects happening. And I'm, the big piece that I'm working on right now is a project with a spoken word poet. She's a poet who does readings of her poems. And so she's written a text and I'm writing a piece, but I'm not setting the text in the traditional way things are set, right? And so she will be performing it with us. So it's sort of like designing the sets for a play, right? I'm setting up these things that are, give these moments for her to do the performance. And that's going to be done in, we're going to do the first, I suppose it's sort of the premiere, but maybe it's sort of like the preview. We're going to do it in New York in February and do it again down in North Carolina. In April.
Where in North Carolina?
East Carolina.
Okay. You'll have to let us
Greenville.
Know. Yeah.
Yeah, we should talk about this one. Well, I know you can cut this out, right? Because yeah. I'm in DC, but I'm mostly in Blowing Rock. I'm mostly up near Boone. So I'm having a guitar piece played in Blowing Rock on Saturday. You should come up. It's That's only great. Like 4 hours. Come on.
Not too bad.
It's about 3 hours. 3 hours.
Clearly I'm re-engaging with this question of text. I'll have an album out probably in a year or so of those art songs, which are collections of a bunch of poems, Wallace Stevens and some other poets, and a really, really dark set of poems that I set for the Byrne Kosar duo, you know, Corinne Byrne and Andy Kosar from Load Bang, for trumpet and soprano. And so that'll be a set. And then I'm doing a piece for Ensemble Nuntempe, a great Argentinian guitar quartet that's taken from has some relationship that I'm still trying to figure out to into some poems from Wallace Stevens' Harmonium. And I'm also starting to work on a piece for Daedalus Quartet and Yoko Bovichute, that's also drawing its title and movement structure from a particular poem by Wallace Stevens of Mere Being. So this question of both a very tight relationship to text through setting, and also these relationships, these resonances that are a couple of yards away from the piece. It's happening a lot. I'm not quite sure why it's happening, right? I'm very happy that it's happening. But that appears to be something that's back in my head in a way that it hadn't been for a long time.
Mm, that's good.
Very exciting.
Yeah.
Mm. Yeah. Well, I want to just say that it has been an absolute blast having you on the show. If anyone out there doesn't know Douglas personally, and I know him personally very, very little, but I can tell you that already I know that this is the kind of person that I could sit down and have a great dinner with, have a beer with, and then have an absolutely hilarious time winding the night down with. Like, just fun, 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 a blast, a blast, a blast. It was really great getting to know you and your music and being able to share it with our listeners too.
Thanks very much. The same here. It was delightful. And hopefully next time in person in North Carolina.
That would be great. You have been listening to the music of composer Douglas Boyce on the Composer Studio. If you want to learn more about the composer and his music, you can visit www.douglasboyce.net. Boyce's music can be heard on New Focus Recordings.
We want to hear from you. Tell us what you think of the show. Have you discovered a living composer you love? Are you a composer who would like to share your music with us? Feel free to drop us a line on Facebook or visit our website and click the Contact Us button.
A lot of heart and soul and cash goes into making the Composer Studio. From music licenses to equipment costs and hosting servers, we could not make this show without the support of our patrons. Don't forget to visit our website and click the Become a Patron button. Thank you for supporting the show and the work of living composers.
Now, Douglas, I chose a quote today that I thought would resonate with you. It's from George Bernard Shaw, Shaw's Pygmalion, because I know you love George Bernard Shaw. Happy is the man who can make a living by his hobby.